Ghoulish greetings, everybody. The tunes are courtesy of the lovely Bobby Mackey, and I, of course, am your host, Tessa Morrow.
With strange mysteries hanging in the air, people in their sane minds swear they see you today. Are you looking for the love they took away? Everyone knows that you couldn't bear the pain, so you took your life in the pouring rain.
Thanks for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers podcast part of your morning, day, night, graveyard shift, whenever you listen and wherever you listen from the hustle and bustle of the big city to the remote mountain town, everything in between, it is absolutely greatly appreciated. This week's special city shoutouts go to Seymour, Texas, Evander, South Africa, Oviedo, Florida, Prescott Valley, Arizona, Redwood City, California, and Fayetteville, West Virginia. Welcome to part two of Words by My Grandfather, True Tells from World War II. I had a great time doing it last time, and I am totally stoked to just jump right into it. So here we go. We have finally reached the most vital part of the game that the big shot countries of the world have been playing for the past 8 or 10 years. This is it. The preliminary were played at Poland, France, Dunkirk, North Africa, and Sicily. This is the invasion of Hitler's fortress Europa. This is the day. This is D-Day. This is the day that the free world has been anticipating for many months, and it will remain forever vivid in my memory. The 62nd Armored Battalion left the port of Weymouth, England, on a LST ship on June 4th, 1944. As far as we knew, this could have been another dry run practice invasion. We previously had 4 or 5 such sessions. We never knew whether it was just a boring dry run or if it were the real thing. This time, however, after we loaded on the burly ship, there seemed to be a different atmosphere in the air. There was a great deal of hustle and bustle around the dock areas, and some of us were betting that this very well could be the real thing. As it turned out, even though it was delayed a day because of the inclement weather, it certainly was the real thing. And I just need to cut in real quick. Remember that one day was because of Marine Sweeney in the premonition episode when she predicted the storm. So just wanted to throw that in there. We were out on the English Channel after boarding the ship at 4 a.m. in the morning. The skyway completely overcast, and the waters of the channel, well, they were very choppy with huge waves pounding against the side of our boat. Shortly after daylight, I walked out on the deck, and I was met with an awesome sight. As far as the eye could see were ships. 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 Destroyers. Cruisers. Huge battleships. And every kind of sea craft imaginable. I said to myself, "Hello, Hitler. Make ready for a visit." That evening, our battery commanders, after a briefing from higher headquarters, gathered us into the huge dining hall of the ship's galley, and they informed us that, at last, this was not just a maneuver, and that we were about to take part in a big invasion on the coast of France and Normandy. We were told that H hour for the first invading troops was to be at 600 hours, 6 a.m. Our battalion was scheduled to go into the beach at 800 hours. We were to disembark at an area known as Omaha Red Beach in support of the 1st Infantry Division. Intelligence reports that were gathered stressed that we were expected to encounter inferior type troops, ostensibly manned by young, inexperienced men and older one-done guard type soldiers. Scuttlebutt. After our briefing was that this invasion would be lighter than when we hit North Africa, where there was no opposition, or when we hit Sicily, where the enemy opposition on the beaches was considerably light. And I thought to myself, yeah, at Africa we faced timid Frenchmen who were happy to yield without a fight. And in Sicily, it was Italian soldiers who individually never did want to fight for Hitler and were happy to throw the towel in and go to prisoner of war camps in America. This time, we will be going up against the Krauts, and I don't think they will welcome us with open arms. And as it turned out, I was right. Oh yes, I was definitely right. The weather suddenly turned very ugly. So bad that we called off the initial plan scheduled for the 5th of June and planned on, weather permitting, executing on the 6th. Briefly, here is how the invasion supposedly was to take place. Shortly after midnight, the battalions of paratroopers were to be dropped behind a line some 7 or 8 miles inland from the coast. Around 3 a.m., heavy bombers were to fly over and saturate the beach area with bombs. At 400 hours, the battleships and cruisers out in the channel were to launch barrage after barrage of heavy shelling into the known coastal enemy positions. Then, as I mentioned before, the initial landing troops, consisting of infantry and engineering units, were to hit the beaches at 600 hours. The infantry and engineering troops were to be loaded into small personnel carrying boats, capacity 100 men, and delivered up close to the shores, where they were expected to wade up to the land and go in fighting. After them followed the armored and tank units. The engineer units were expected to effect openings for tanks and ammo units to traverse up the beaches. I will here describe yet another big snafu encountered by we in the 62nd. As many dry runs that we went through in England preparing for the invasion, we never once practiced how, actually, we were going into the beaches. And here is how we went in. We went in on a raft. Sounds strange, but it really was a raft. There was this long, flat barge. It was 100 yards long, just like a football field, and it was about that wide, and it was self-propelled with two large propelled motors on the end of it. Two of them were towed by two LST boats. From England, our tanks and armored equipment was loaded on the rafts. Also, many of our big trucks loaded with gasoline, ammunition, and rations were on the rafts. Incidentally, the rafts were called rhinos. And at 3 a.m. on the day of the invasion, we were to climb down rope ladders from the LST onto the Rhino. First time I ever went down on a rope ladder. It's kind of tough going down a couple of stories on a rope ladder on a very rough rolling sea, weighed down with a field pack, a rifle, and an ammunition belt. Not to mention the Mae West life preserver that we had to wear. Shortly after 3, I, with the rest of us sad sacks, struggled down and got out on the Rhino. The weather was very bad. It was raining and the wind was blowing very hard. Huge waves rolled over the floors of the Rhino. We had to be very careful because, conceivably, we could be washed over or blown over the sides of the Rhino. I was sitting in a truck bemoaning our plights with Sergeant Roebuck, when suddenly the sky was filled with tracer bullets and AK-AK. A Ju-87 German light bomber was hedge-hopping over our area. It passes through the glare of searchlights, and luckily it was hit by our AK-AK, caught on fire and plunged into the water, less than 100 yards from the Rhino that we were on. How it missed hitting one of our ships in the Armada, I'll never know. Then I thought, Christ, if that plane had landed on our barge, loaded with gasoline and ammunition, we would have been blown to kingdom come. Shortly after the incident, the blasting to the beaches started from the big battleships and cruisers behind us. It was deafening to the ears, and it was really a sight to behold. You could actually see some of the missiles, the balls of fire, flying through the air over our heads from the big guns of the battleships. So now, in spite of the delays, in spite of the bad weather, the invasion truly had started. I was hoping that we would hurry and get off this powder keg that we were on, slowly inching our way toward Omaha Red Beach. It was now after 5, and dawn was breaking. So far, there was no incoming fire from the beach installations or no enemy planes, which I was mostly sweating out. And now, as it got lighter, wave after wave of Allied fighting planes, Mustangs, P-47 Thunderbolts, and British Spitfires came flying over to strafe and bomb enemy positions inland. Really, this was getting to be quite a show for which we had ringside seats. We in the 62nd were just hours away from doing our bit part in the show going on there on Omaha Beach. I got a pair of field glasses and moved over close to the edge of the Rhino. Crazy me. I was sitting on a box full of 105mm shells. What the heck? It didn't make any difference where you sat on that Rhino, because if shells happened to land on it, it would be adios for us. Anyways, I was sitting there looking through the binoculars, and I was mainly focused on nearby LCI boats, landing craft infantry, where infantry and engineer troops were loading onto the small assault, 100 men to a boat, and that would take them into the beach. As miserable as conditions were for me, I thanked God that I wasn't in the infantry or the engineers then, because surely they were going into a scorpion's nest, the likes of which was unparalleled in the history of the world as far as assault landings on foreign soil. I think that going into the beaches, the engineers actually had the worst of it, because as they dodged enemy fire, it was their job to locate and deactivate mines, of which, you know, were strewn all over the areas that had to be taken. Now, as I watched through the glasses, I really felt sorry for those GIs that were loading into the assault boats. They were heavily weighed down with rifles, telephone and communication equipment, mortars, and ammunition and other equipment that had to be used after getting onto the beach. The immediate problem that faced them was not the inevitable enemy pressure, but it was the weather elements. The rain had stopped, but the wind was blowing hard, and it was cold and overcast. And after they got on the boats, they were out on the water. They were tossed unmercifully around on the huge waves that enveloped them. I thought, my God, are they going to make it onto that beach? Shortly, I could see many, many of those little boats inching their way toward land. Suddenly, the force of the wind seemed to get worse. I saw at least 10 of the boats, I'm sure there were more, thrown up in the air, turned over and sinking, with GIs floundering helplessly on the water. These poor guys didn't have a chance. Sadly, there must have been at least 1,000 men drowned out there as those many boats capsized in the violent waters. It was obvious to me that the Supreme Command that postponed the original invasion date from the 5th of June to the 6th of June because of the weather should have postponed it even more till at least the weather calmed down a little. One more snafu. As the assault boats that survived the raging waters arrived close to the beach, the German entrenched beach positions began firing on them. It seemed like all hell broke loose. The shells were badly coming in from the battleships. Our fighter planes were strafing enemy positions on the cliffs overlooking the beach, and 88's mortars and machine gun fire was coming in from the enemy. Now the real carnage began. The assault boats pulled up in the shallow water near the shore, dropped their unloading gates, and the men began wading through the water, running up the beaches. Wave after wave of the small boats were unloading men in the shallow water, and wave after wave of them were immediately cut down by deadly machine gun and mortar fire, coming in from enemy emplacements that were dug in high up on the cliffs, overlooking the action taking place down on the sands. I'm saying now to Sergeant Roebuck, "My God, we are scheduled to go in at 800 hours. How the hell can we make it through all of that?" It's a laugh. What they told us when they briefed us and said the beach at Omaha Red will be very lightly manned by inferior troops. If these are inferior troops, what the hell are their crack troops like? I noticed an object bobbing up and down on the side of the Rhino. I went over and looked, and I was jolted by what I saw. The body of a young American sailor was floating right near the edge of the raft. For a moment, I thought he was alive because his eyes, well, they were wide open and appeared to be looking right at me. I called Sergeant Roebuck over and told him, "Help me," and we lifted him up and laid him under a truck that was chained down on the floor of the Rhino. The situation was getting very crucial. It was real tough because about 100 yards in from the shore, there on the left, was a high cliff with gun emplacements strategically dug in, many of them in concrete pill boxes, and they had the whole beach area zeroed in with their machine guns and mortars. Operation was completely stalemated. No more infantry troops were sent in to assault the beach. Our offensive came to an abrupt halt. Our fighter planes seemed like our only hope now, and they sent many of them over the area where the Germans were dug in. And they did meet with some success, knocking out some of the emplacements, but what saved the day and opened up a breach in the German defenses, believe it or not, was two naval destroyers. And I can't understand why. I have never read about this feat. Nor have I ever seen any sort of a documentary or a World War II movie where they explained how two destroyers actually made it possible for the Allied armies to secure a foothold on Omaha Red Beach that fatal day known as D-Day. Without the heroic efforts of those two ships, I am sure we never could have made it that day. It was like a last-minute rescue by the hero in a Western movie. And here's what happened. The two ships were used mostly as guardians of the right flank of the huge armada laying out in the channel. They were ordered in to move up and down the perimeter just in front of the cliffs where the awesome firepower was coming in from the enemy. They moved up and down, firing heavy barrages into the pill boxes and dug in gun emplacements. I couldn't believe it. From where we were on the Rhino, it looked like those two ships were actually on the beach as they traversed back and forth. They knocked out many of the gun emplacements and made it possible for some of the infantrymen who did make it to the beach, remaining ones, and silence them with the hand grenades and small arms. And those infantrymen, they too were truly heroic. Can you imagine a picture of all of this that was going on that memorable day? The weather, it was wet, cold, windy, and it was miserable. Shells from our Navy were whistling overhead. Our planes, flying low, seemed to help the weather vibrate the water of the channel with the noise of their roaring engines. The enemy was now firing out at vessels close to the beach. Thank God at that point our Rhinos were barely out of their range, unless they began employing their dreaded 88mm guns. It was noisy and confusing, and about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, after the enemy shore emplacements had been neutralized, our infantry and engineer troops were able to go into the beaches without too much opposition. At about 6 in the evening, our Rhino was able to be pushed up the sand, and we were able to go ashore. It's hard Well, it's difficult to describe the horrible devastation that was on that beach. It was strewn with bodies of GIs who were killed in the early enemy onslaughts. It was hard to take a normal step without having to jump over a dead body. Jeeps and small amphibious vehicles were burning and smoldering after having run over mines. Tanks were being rushed off of the rhinos. I saw some run over and crushed bodies of GIs laying in their paths. Although we were finally able to get on the beach, our situation, well, it was extremely precarious. The enemy was driven back some 10,000 yards from the beach, but they were entrenched in a solid defensive position, and they were firing artillery and mortar shells in the area occupied by us. And there were snipers hidden up in the cliffs, taking pot shots at personnel on the beach. Mass confusion prevailed. Everything was screwed up and disorganized. Colonel Bennett, our battalion commander, who later was decorated for his action, took it upon himself to organize as best as he could the confusion that reigned. He directed our tanks, some from other units, into positions where they could assault the probable enemy positions and give support to the troop that were clinging to a small area up from the beaches. I myself was in a half track with six others in my section. We were heading up inland to an area under the cliffs. We were right behind another of our half tracks when we were jolted by a loud explosion that made the earth move. The vehicle in front of us ran over a mine and was totally destroyed. One of the bodies that was thrown into the air landed on the hood of our half track. My God. It was Sergeant Roebuck, my very good friend, who helped me pull that sailor up on the rhino just a few short hours before, and a guy who was really a good buddy of mine. He and the others in that half track were the first casualties of the 62nd on D-Day. We pulled up into an area near the cliff. It was beginning to get dark. I was cold and hungry and very tired. Thank God it had stopped raining, but it was miserably cold. As I sat in the half track with my blanket wrapped around me Indian style, I thought over the events so far that took place on that memorable day. All the poor infantrymen and engineers that drowned in the channel, the young sailor that drifted up to the rhino, the unloading onto the beach, bodies on the beach being crushed by our tanks, my buddy Roebuck, and now here we are, all disorganized, precariously holding onto a small plot of ground yards away from a ruthless enemy. I remember President Roosevelt saying several times, "War is hell!" Yes, yes, war definitely is hell. So far, after seeing all the death and destruction, I considered myself very lucky. I was still alive and breathing, but believe me, I was very apprehensive about whether I would remain that way for very long. I kept thinking, and so help me, I will never know why the Germans didn't launch a counterattack that night and wipe us right back into the sea. Okay, that's the ending of part two. Hope you enjoyed it. First-hand account of World War II and D-Day. This was about my grandpa Gerald, and he passed away. He's been gone about 20 years now. I miss him. I think about him all the time. You could still hear his voice. And now I want to share yet another phenomenal voice. My grandpa Ernie. You've heard from him before. Well, you've heard about him before. He's the one who just turned 100 years old this past May, and I am so lucky to get to go see him when I'm in Arizona, which is every year. So I already saw him once this year, twice actually, for his birthday and just a few weeks ago, and I'm going to see him when I go out there in October, and I can't be more excited about that. But just one real quick story. My mom and him were always so close. They hadn't seen each other in about 30 years. And so it was neat that I finally got to bring her to go see him. And he loves karaoke. He's still pretty active. And he does karaoke every week. He was supposed to go that particular day. And my mom's like, "Well, let's take you. I'd love to hear you sing." And he's like, "Oh, no, sweetheart. I don't want to go anywhere right now. I just want to relax here and chat with you." And she's like, "Well, that's a bummer because I have never heard you sing before." And he starts to belt this out.
With a drink in her hand, she had ruby red lips and coal black hair and eyes that would tempt any man. She sat down at my table, placing her soft hands in mine. I found myself wanting to kiss her, for temptation was flowing like wine, and I was almost persuaded to lips myself of my pride, almost persuaded to give myself away. Then we danced, and she said, I need you. Take me away from here and be my man.
And he, too, was in World War II. He was a medic. I cannot even begin to imagine the things that he experienced and saw and had to deal with. I have always been a huge fan of the military, the first responders, and I really truly do look up to you all. So the men and women who are listening, who are currently in the military, were a long time ago, or someone you love was in the military or no longer with you or whatever, I just adore you guys and gals. Really appreciate you, respect you, and honor you. And thank you from the bottom of my heart. And still to this very day, I see somebody with it, you know, usually it's with a hat on, saying which war they were in or whatever. I always have to go up to them and say thank you for your service. It's greatly appreciated. So thank you for your service. It is absolutely appreciated. Really hope you guys all enjoyed part two, and look out for part three in the future. Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They are all phenomenal. Haven't heard every single one yet? Well, there is no need to dread, fret, worry, or cry. That's right. You can binge listen right now to your heart's fright and delight by hitting up any of those spectacular podcast platforms such as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Downcast, CastBox, Pocket Cast. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers Podcast lurking in the background. Thanks, everybody, and have a wonderful day. And I will see you next week.